couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films The Marksman, MLK FBI, One Night in Miami, Outside the Wire, and Hunted. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring a look back at the latest James Bond movie, Spectre. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news is looking back into the James Bond franchise. As I mentioned, I'm going to be talking about Spectre, and I'll explain why later on. But that's the bridge into No Time to Die, which is the next James Bond movie, which was supposed to come out almost a year ago in April. But it got moved throughout the pandemic into the November range, and now it's been moved to April again. And apparently, this may be one that might move again. I've been telling people I wouldn't worry about all the other films on the docket right now, especially Disney and Warner Brothers, because they certainly have set themselves up to have a streaming option, or at least a hybrid model of streaming and theatrical releases. But No Time to Die is interesting to watch because that's the big tentpole that does not have a streaming option. And apparently, they did shop it around to the streaming service, and the word on the street is they were offered upwards of $600 million to put that movie onto a streaming service or do a direct sale event or something like that. And Eon Productions said no. This is an answer as to why I think the Bond movies are starting to have problems. If you look at just the schedule of Bond movies, they rebooted this stuff in 2006, and then in 2008, they did Quantum of Solace, 2012, Skyfall, 2015, Spectre, and it was supposed to be 2020. 5 years later, 2020 was supposed to be No Time to Die. I mean, we are 15 years after the first Daniel Craig Bond movie. We've only gotten four movies, and a fifth one has yet to come out. Compare that to the first 20, 30 years of Bond, where they were putting out a new movie every 2 years. And that's what makes Bond work. But the part of the problem is that once Skyfall made as much money as it did and became an international blockbuster with a billion plus, suddenly the studio wants to throw all the money into it. James Bond is a cash cow, and it would have worked as a cash cow as it did from the 60s through the 90s, where they covered most of their expenses with product placement. I remember, I think it was the film, I think The World Is Not Enough or Tomorrow Never Dies, one of the Pierce Brosnan movies. The budget was like $135 million, and like $115 million of that was money they were directly paid for product placement from places like Absolut Vodka and BMW and Nokia phones or whatever, whoever was involved in this stuff. That's a lot of money that they just basically made the movie. They made this massive $135 million movie for like $20 million. And then whatever they made in the box office, they just reaped in the profits. But the movies have gotten so big now that they have to be these billion-dollar blockbusters. They're trying to run the model that Marvel has done, but without any of the supporting movies. That everything needs to be in Avengers movies. And even now, I mean, the last movie that we had that was a James Bond movie came out when the second Avengers movie, they had a double dose of Avengers, and then you throw in other big, huge moneymakers like Captain Marvel and Black Panther as well, and we still haven't gotten the next Bond movie. Bond needs to scale their budgets back and just do a good old-fashioned spy drama and just do it as a cash cow without having everything have to be this big blockbuster, which, again, I think is playing out with this post-pandemic world where I think that the blockbuster model, the one where you have to put $300 million into a movie, may not be the best option anymore, which I'm all for scaling some of that back. Another piece of news that I found kind of interesting is Quibi, or Quibi, its library is not going to disappear. Of course, that was that quick service that actually didn't even last through the pandemic. The short bites, each episode was like 5 to 10 minutes long, and they broke stuff up. And they actually had some interesting stuff there. They had some real crap there, too. But they had this huge slate of programming, and they put billions of dollars in, and they ended up going under at the end of last year. But they have sold their library to Roku. So the Roku channel is going to be exhibiting this stuff, which is good because at least it has a place for some of these movies to go. I mean, the movie that Liam Hemsworth did with Christoph Waltz, that wasn't a terrible film, The Most Dangerous Game. And also their 50 States of Fright, I actually thought was really pretty good. I thought it was on the level at least of what Creepshow was being put together on Shudder. So I'd love to see that kind of find a new life on another network, basically like Shudder or something like that. There is a big announcement from Netflix, but I actually want to push that one into the trailer park. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is the Netflix announcement for their films in 2021.
Hello, world. Gal Gadot is here.
And Uncle Handsome.
Whoa. And Ryan.
Yeah. What I love about movies is that they can make you feel every emotion.
And show you something you've never seen before.
I love showing people what a superhero can look like.
I like making any movie where I get to throw stuff.
We truly love movies.
We do, but what we love even more is making movies for fans like you.
What's interesting about this is Netflix has doubled down on its use of films. They're not just doing TV shows and series, but they took the pandemic to really focus on doing their movies. And they got a slate, and they're promising a new movie or movies every week, every Friday. They might drop it on other days other than Fridays, but pretty much you can assume that every Friday there's going to be a new movie on Netflix. Now, you may not want to watch it. It might be The Kissing Booth Part 3. But they look like they've really thrown some money in there, and they got some stars. I remember a couple of years ago when Sandra Bullock did Bird Box, I was like, that was somewhat significant because she was a major star who did a movie on Netflix. And you had other people like, you had the Coen brothers working on Netflix and then Soderbergh working on Netflix. So I think that line, because of all the talent and the big names, have crossed that line between theatrical and streaming, that they no longer look at that as just, oh, that's just some series for the web. And now they're really ready to double down because you hear it talked about by people like Ryan Reynolds, Gal Gadot, and Dwayne Johnson. These are going to be big movies. You've also hear people like Halle Berry and Melissa McCarthy and Octavia Spencer and Regina King. There's a lot of people that have movies coming out. So Netflix is the one to watch throughout the year, and they don't even have release dates for all of these yet. The next trailer I want to talk about is a little bit more traditional, and that is Barb and Star Go to Del Mar. Comes out on February 12th.
Hey, Barb.
Yes, Star.
You know what I just love?
What?
Movie trailers.
Me too.
I like how they're little movies about another movie before a different movie.
Sometimes I find myself watching a trailer for a movie while I'm watching a totally different movie.
What? Me too.
Barb, what if we had a movie?
What?
Then we'd have to have a trailer.
Oh, yes, listen, I wouldn't want to give anything away, though, about the movie.
Me neither, especially our faces.
Gosh, I can almost see our trailer now.
This is meant to be whimsical and silly, and it's got Kristen Wiig and another woman, Annie Milamo, which I'm not terribly familiar with her work. I would probably recognize her if I've seen her in stuff, but Kristen Wiig's a more recognizable person for me in this one. But this is about two women who go on a vacation and find some weird, crazy conspiracy. It looked like it might be kind of fun. Well, they say it's from the people who did Bridesmaids, but that's mainly Kristen Wiig. But it's got Adam McKay and Will Ferrell behind it, and I like them. When they say Bridesmaids, I immediately think of Judd Apatow, but I'm not a big Judd Apatow fan, and I would rather see McKay and Ferrell's involvement than Judd Apatow. So this one looks like it might be kind of fun. I mean, you do get some absurd stuff that comes out of some of these minds. So, it looks like it might be funny. I just hope it doesn't overdo it. And that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about One Night in Miami and Outside the Wire. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump right into the movie reviews and talk about One Night in Miami. This one actually was in theaters. It's been in limited release since, I think, Christmas. Anything that's in theaters is in limited release because there's a lot of theaters that still aren't open in some states. Now it's available this week on Amazon Prime. So if you've got the Amazon Prime service, you can watch it no extra charge. This adaptation of a play suggests a pivotal night in 1964 in which Malcolm X, Cassius Clay, Sam Cooke, and Jim Brown gather in a motel where they discuss their impact on Black America.
I think it's about time to party.
Tonight is a chance for us to reflect.
You mean no one else is coming?
Well, this is off to a hopping start.
You all are a bright and shining future.
You need to understand what is at stake here.
Everything's not so black and white like you make it out to be.
But we are fighting for our lives.
You know I know what's going on out there, right?
First of all, this is not a real event. It's not based on an actual thing that happened, but the four of these guys were friends in real life. So it's more of a suggestion of these people getting together. And it's based on a stage play, and that makes sense when you see the movie. It for the good chunk of it takes place almost entirely in this single motel room. And what's makes it interesting is it's not that it's the first time we've seen these characters portrayed on screen. But what it does is it puts them together, like Sam Cooke and Jim Brown are the ones you don't necessarily expect to be in there. And I wouldn't say that Jim Brown was exactly a pioneer in the civil rights movement. And Sam Cooke wasn't really either, but they were both influential. And so here you have people with four different areas, but they're very influential African Americans at the time. You have two sports stars, but the sports stars are very, very different. You know, Jim Brown's rough and tumble. He's with the Cleveland Browns. He's football. He's trying to transition into movies. You got Cassius Clay on the eve of changing his name to Muhammad Ali, which in itself is interesting because I was born in 1971. So I grew up with Muhammad Ali as Muhammad Ali. And the name Cassius Clay is a footnote in history as well, as far as I'm concerned. I never knew him as Cassius Clay. I mean, a lot of people did and a lot of people historically did. But it's interesting to look how the perspective changes looking into the middle of his career, or at least in the burgeoning part of his career. Cassius Clay was very much into himself. He was about building up his brand, and he was certainly on his way up to become one of the greatest boxers of all time. Sam Cooke, while he's well-known, he's not just a singer, but he was a producer and a writer, and he talks about his influence and how he has worked the music industry. But the most interesting character in here, I think, is Malcolm X. Because Malcolm X was such a polarizing figure, and all the stuff you're ever going to see, like archive footage of Malcolm X, he's, for lack of a better term, he's in character. He's a preacher. He's in front of a microphone. He's talking to people, and he's always had that image of the angry young black man. And sometimes to his credit and sometimes to his detriment. And even, you know, a movie like Malcolm X, which is directed by Spike Lee, is probably, in my opinion, Spike Lee's best film. Denzel Washington does a great job portraying Malcolm Little through his transition to Malcolm X. But you still have that very hard, chiseled veneer over him. And one of the things this movie does is it gives a little bit more humanity to him, which you never see. You never see the humanity of Malcolm X. You always see the angry young black man causing problems and then getting assassinated by the Nation of Islam. And it really shows a look at how each one has a different influence and each one has a different goal, but how those goals can overlap. Now, this is directed by Regina King, and I didn't even know that until I got pretty much to the end of the movie. And it rolls credits, and I'm like, gosh, Regina King. Talk about somebody who's having a renaissance in her career. I think she had like one or two starring roles. She played like Will Smith's girlfriend or wife in Enemy of the State, but she ended up being kind of dismissed as she got older. But boy, she did If Beale Street Could Talk, got a bunch of awards and nominations for that. She did Watchmen, got a lot of exposure for that, and now she's directing a feature film, which is a pretty solid movie. This is a movie, if you want to like watch the people talk and get into the dialogue, because that's really what it's about. But it's also an interesting snapshot into this 1964 life, where it's before, obviously, you know, Malcolm X was assassinated, before MLK was assassinated, and before Cassius Clay changed his identity to Muhammad Ali. So it really is an interesting historical film, and I think it's worth seeing. I'm going to say it rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the next film, which is on Netflix. It's called Outside the Wire. A drone pilot is given a disciplinary assignment where his commanding officer is a cyborg that takes him into a war zone to deliver medicine.
Do you know why you're here?
Yeah, because I broke chain of command.
Harp, he's not like us.
What are you, AI?
I'm a prototype, and my existence is classified.
But I can't do this alone. I need someone who could think outside the box.
That's why you're here.
I chose you. Sometimes you gotta get dirty to see any real change.
Welcome to the war, kid.
This one stars Anthony Mackie as the robot. I don't know if he's a cyborg or a robot. I guess he's a robot. I mean, cyborg would have actual human elements to it, but I think he's completely artificial. But he plays the robot, and it's interesting because part of the thing is most of what I've seen Anthony Mackie in, he's always in a movie with somebody taller than him. You know, even if something like going back to the Adjustment Bureau. He was with Matt Damon, and Matt Damon's taller than him, and Emily Blunt's in that movie, and she's kind of tall, too. And then, of course, he's in the Avengers movies, and he's with Chris Evans, who's a couple inches taller than him already, and you've got other people like Chris Hemsworth playing Thor, and all these people that tower over him. I always think of him as a smaller guy, but he's like 5'10", 5'11", something like that. And it gives him a chance to be sort of that action hero in this one, or maybe anti-hero. The other thing with this is it gives him a chance to kind of audition to maybe do some Captain America stuff. Now, I know there just news came out that Chris Evans is in negotiations and trying to be brought back into playing Captain America again. But of course, you know, the next thing would be that Falcon would usher his way into Captain America. So I think Anthony Mackie does a good job holding his own as the action hero, much better than he did in stuff like Synchronic and some of the other gritty cop movies he's done. Overall, it's an interesting futuristic science fiction action movie, but the biggest problem I have with this film is it's unclear where the story is even going. Until you get to like the twists and turns, you know, they show how this drone pilot gets disciplined and then him trying to figure out what it's like to deal with this superior officer who's a cyborg or a robot. And then we're just kind of along for the ride until we suddenly find out something that's happening later. And I'm like, oh, well, then that's what the movie's about. Yeah. You know, it's fraying around and falling apart until it gets from. You know, in the act two, I said to a friend of mine who sent me a screenplay because he wanted me to see if the screenplay was any good. And I said, most writers have trouble with the second act because that's what bridges the beginning and the end. And that's where all the character development takes place. And that's, I think, where this movie struggles the most. And that's why, I mean, while it has some good action sequences, overall, I got to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Marksman and MLK/FBI. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about The Marksman. Liam Neeson stars as a widowed rancher who becomes responsible for bringing a boy from Mexico to his family in Chicago while fleeing a ruthless cartel.
You're never going to make it. It's miles to the nearest road. I'll call Border Patrol.
Please, no.
I come here to take the woman and the boy.
I was in the Marine Corps,
so I suggest you all turn around and adios.
I'm a soldier too. My orders are to take them back with me.
Damn well ought to appreciate what I'm doing for you. I'm taking you to your family in Chicago. After that, I don't care what you do.
The man you saw at the border is from the Vasquez cartel. He will kill you.
I think it is contractually obligated to the people of the world that Liam Neeson gets an action movie every 6 to 12 months. Now, they had just had Honest Thief came out, and I think that was in September, if I'm not mistaken. So it's a little bit close, but he also had the one before that, which was the Snowplow Driver, Cold Pursuit. But, you know, we've been getting a Liam Neeson action movie every year or so for the last 10 years. And, you know, I got to say, I like these movies. I like Liam Neeson. I think he works well on screen. Not all of the movies are great, like The Walk Behind the Tombstones was terrible. But some of them are fun, like the ones that, like the, like Unknown or the Taken movies, or what was that one where he was on the train with Vera Farmiga? That was a pretty good one. The thing I noticed is, and I said this about Honest Thief last time I reviewed one of his movies, he's really getting old. And I mean, that's not a complaint. That's just the reality of time. I mean, Liam Neeson's in his late 60s now. So him doing the fisticuffs is a little bit tough to get through. I mean, when he was doing like Taken, even then he was in his 50s. So he was at the waning edge of action movie ability. But now, and I notice this with Honest Thief, it happens as well in The Marksman, he doesn't engage the people as much. And I think they're just limited by what they can do with him as a senior citizen. I like the fact that he still makes these movies. I mean, but he's like always got something, like in Honest Thief, he was like running cars into people. In this one, he's a marksman, so he's able to shoot a weapon. And he has a couple times when he scruffs it up with some guys. But it's pretty much his forte is being able to shoot things. Well, you can shoot things without, you know, breaking your hip in the process. So by its nature and by this nature, the movie itself has to not be as action-y of an action movie as you want. It has some neat stuff at the beginning. It has a decent thing at the end. The middle does tend to lag a little bit. Part of it is because they're trying to develop the characters and not do too much action with them. But they're also, the characters kind of do stupid things where you're like, I can't believe you didn't realize that. And then the other thing is the cartel's chasing him because he kills one of the guy's brothers in the first shootout. And so then the guy's relentlessly pursuing him because, you know, it's revenge. But they're in America just willy-nilly. I mean, just wiping people out, killing anybody they come across. And I'm like, they're not very subtle. And then, of course, by the time he gets up to, like, you know, Oklahoma and Missouri, I'm like, well, at that point, you're well far out of the Southwest that I don't know if the cartel has that much power that far north. I mean, you're starting to get into the Midwest. You're starting to get into a completely different area. So there's a lot of logic holes in here. And as you would expect, any movie like this does have a lot of logic holes to it. But I mean, I think Liam Neeson does a good job in his role. He manages to play both the badass, which he's in this movie, and the nice guy, you know, sort of the would-be father figure, because he's widowed and his ranch is going under. So he's kind of at the end of his life, and he takes his kid under his wing because the mom gets killed. And, you know, so it does have that father figure element to it, but it still is a little bit weird and doesn't play as well as it could. But I mean, he's tender enough of a guy. He can play both the mean guy and a good guy too. So I like Liam Neeson in it. I like the beginning and the end. The middle's kind of goofy, but overall, because I know we're getting diminishing returns with these Liam Neeson action movies, but it's, I think, a little bit better constructed than that last Rambo movie, even though it has similar themes. So I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the next film, which is MLK/FBI. This documentary examines the tense relationship between Dr. Martin Luther King and the FBI, including its overbearing surveillance on him.
The FBI was most alarmed about King because of his success.
He realized how sick this country was. We were trying to reveal the truth about segregation.
J. Edgar Hoover is famous for saying that he feared the rise of a black messiah.
The FBI says it's clear Martin Luther King Jr. is the most dangerous Negro in America, and we have to use every resource at our disposal to destroy him.
This is in theaters right now, and I believe it's also available on demand. And and that's what makes it a good watch for this weekend, because it's Martin Luther King Day on Monday. Now, what's interesting, again, I mentioned this when I was talking about One Night in Miami. I was born right at the tail end of like a lot of the civil rights stuff, but I grew up in the shadow of all that. I was born 3 years after Dr. King was assassinated. So by the time I was aware of any sort of current event, even as a little kid watching these in the news breaks when I'm like in first or second grade during cartoons on Saturday mornings, Dr. King had become, he'd become a martyr and he'd become a symbol of the civil rights movement. He'd become a symbol of peace and there was no angst about him. But in the 60s, there certainly was, especially between him and J. Edgar Hoover. And his relationship with like John Kennedy was good, but his relationship with Johnson had its issues mainly because as he got later in his career, Dr. King was very critical of Vietnam. And there was a lot of surveillance from the FBI, especially in the 60s, with J. Edgar Hoover, because they were afraid of the politics of what black people could stand for and the fact that they didn't know what it was. And they did not represent the typical G-man, wholesome American, crew-cut, blonde-haired, blue-eyed guy that you would expect J. Edgar Hoover would have on his team. You know, let's face it, either working for him or, you know, for recreational purposes as well. But here's the thing. The fact that they were targeting Martin Luther King and how they were targeting Martin Luther King is disturbing. And all that stuff is going to be coming due in terms of Freedom of Information Act and accessibility to the public in like 6 years. And there's some inflammatory stuff for Dr. King that the FBI had amassed. And I think a lot of this movie is almost trying to reveal the stuff that was really overstepped, overreached, you know, the stuff where they're just digging dirt so they could take him down, but he wasn't necessarily committing any crimes. I mean, they were surveilling him, but they weren't surveilling him because they were afraid he was going to bomb something. They just worried about him because he was a very influential African American at the time. And that shows where the FBI was just 50 years ago. And that's, I think, important to watch. I think it's important to point out. I think that's important to dissect and keep in our own minds for today because, you know, you can look at the FBI and look, positive law enforcement and everything like that, but that does not mean that some investigations might be politically motivated. And that happens even today. And this is different than just a basic biopic of Martin Luther King because it focuses so much on his relationship with the government rather than the good deeds he was trying to do and the advancements he was making for civil rights. We all know that. And that's not what the point of this movie is. The point of this movie is to show, and I think, and that's what I took away from it, the unfair, overbearing surveillance that they did on him for no good reason, really. Aside for the fact that he was a powerful Negro in the 60s. And that does not stand up well. And, they tried to smooth it out because, of course, they did a huge investigation when he was assassinated. But that doesn't mean that it makes it all right. So I think this is a level of cynicism that's in this documentary that I think people should have, especially when looking at the history of Dr. King. So I'm going to say it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Hunted and the Home Cinema Roundup with a spotlight on Spectre. At the movies with Kevin Carr. Let's go into the final segment here with a little piece of diversion. I forgot to play this in the first segment. I got distracted by James Bond and Netflix slate of films. But we got a voicemail, and I thought I'd throw this out there. Nobody identified themselves. This is just all I got in the voicemail, and it's a listener review, so let's go ahead and play it.
Wonder Woman rocks. Yeehaw!
Like I said, I don't know who sent it. I don't know who is the person behind this, but apparently somebody enjoyed Gal Gadot in her miniskirt in Wonder Woman 1984. So there you go. A listener review. If you want to send in more listener reviews, You can do so. You can just call 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. And you can record yourself giving it a review. Nothing blue, no swearing, nothing like that, because this is a family program. But if you want to sound off on your own for the Fat Guys at the Movies radio program, now is a chance to do so. And now we're going to move into the final movie review, which is a horror film on Shudder, which, of course, is the premium horror station, genre station. It does a lot of horror and thriller and slasher movies. And they did, of course, a Creepshow holiday special. I talked about that last month, and a couple other films. You know, I'm a huge fan of horror movies, so I always like to cover a little bit. So, you know, I apologize if you're not into horror movies, that's okay. I hope I can make it entertaining. Otherwise, this film is called Hunted. And like I said, it plays exclusively on the Shudder web service. This allegory to Red Riding Hood sees a kidnapped woman escape into the woods, trying to evade capture again and learning to fight back.
Only a handful entered the forest. Giant wolves ran wild.
Yes!
The young girl's pure song had awoken the forest. And it wished to protect her. Forest was a defender of the innocent. It sends harsh and punishing emissaries.
This is directed by the guy who did Persepolis, which was an animated film, oh gosh, 13, 14 years ago. Actually, a very well done, esoteric, meaningful movie about a young girl living and growing up in Iran before the Islamic Revolution and how things changed once it went through this this sort of religious transformation. But in this movie, it's more straightforward horror movie. Like I said in the description, it's an allegory to Red Riding Hood, where it's this woman who is, she's got a red coat on and she's not being chased by wolves. She has been abducted by sexual predators and she gets a chance to escape and she ends up in the woods. And, you know, nature kind of helps her out in a certain way while these guys are trying to track her down and ultimately capture her again. Now, if you don't like the sort of predator and prey type movie like this, it's not one of those movies where, you know, it's not like I Spit on Your Grave or anything like that, where you just have a nonstop punishing attack. That stuff doesn't really happen in this situation. It's her trying to escape that from happening. And of course, the guy who's the main bad guy, the big bad wolf, so to speak, he's pretty formidable, and it's her trying to use her wits and survival just instincts on her own. And it gets kind of crazy and over the top, and it does put you in that what would you do position in multiple instances, not just with her, but people that she runs into and tries to get help from. It's an effective movie. It's visceral. And it's pretty violent, but it's an interesting movie simply because if you know going in that it's a allegory to the Red Riding Hood story, it gives you a little bit of deeper meaning. But overall, it is one of those revenge to your attackers type movies. And overall, I enjoyed it. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today, I'm going to be talking about the movie Spectre, which is the latest James Bond movie before No Time to Die comes out, maybe in April or maybe a little bit later. But this came out back in 2015. In this James Bond film, he comes up against a deadly worldwide criminal organization headed by Ernst Stavro Blofeld.
So what's going on, James? They say you're finished.
What do you think?
I think you're just getting started.
Tell me where he is.
He's everywhere.
This organization. Do you know what it's called?
Its name is Spectre.
And do you know who links them all?
Me.
I had seen this movie only once before, and that was at the press screening back in 2015. I am a huge James Bond fan. I've watched the whole series before, and a year or two ago, I got as a gift, I got it for myself, as a Christmas gift, the complete Bond 50 collection, which had everything from Dr. No, all the Eon productions up until Skyfall. And they have a little slot in there for Spectre because that thing came out in 2013 or 2014 or something like that. The Blu-ray box set. And I always wanted to go through all of them. I just want to make sure the Blu-rays worked more than anything else. And they do. And none of them were damaged. And so, I'm able to watch all of the James Bond movies now. And so for Christmas this year, I had asked for the Blu-ray of Spectre. So, there was actually a slot in the box set that you could put the Spectre Blu-ray. And I remember watching this, back in 2015 and being, I wouldn't say disappointed, but sort of let down. Sort of like the air got let out of my tires with this movie. There's some parts about it that are wonderful. I mean, this is probably the best looking Bond film that has been ever made. I mean, Skyfall looked gorgeous. There was some beautiful cinematography in Skyfall, but they really double down and they do even more amazing cinematic efforts and color saturation and has some beautiful wide shots. I don't know if any of it was shot with 70 millimeter cameras for the IMAX screen. I remember seeing it in IMAX and I remember back then it just looks gorgeous. Like I said, it's just a beautiful looking movie and it has certain elements of James Bond that you would expect. It goes back to the elements of him being a bit of a scoundrel and hopping from bed to bed. You've got the snow fights. You've got the car chases. You've got some freaky henchmen and you've got the return of Blofeld. And that, of course, is who Christoph Waltz is playing. But there's something missing there. Part of it is Blofeld has a sort of a fraught history in the James Bond movies because it was created not by Ian Fleming, but by the guy who helped write and develop Thunderball. And so he had this hold over it rights-wise, which is why he was able to remake Thunderball as Never Say Never Again back in 1983. But once this guy died, the rights were kind of up for it and they kind of have rolled this all back into the James Bond franchise. But I think the essence of what makes Spectre not work is it doesn't understand James Bond. It doesn't understand that James Bond should not be developed. The character should not get humanity because in the end, James Bond's not a good guy. He just works for the good guys. He's a sociopath. I mean, he's an assassin who can disassociate from abject murdering of people. And you need that in a spy. And there needs to be a certain amount of, space between reality of ours and the reality of what he is. And I think that doesn't come across in this movie. And overall in all of the Craig Bonds from Casino Royale all the way up to Spectre and even into No Time to Die, all of them have Bond either leaving, either he's on leave or he quits or he's fired or he's sent away and he has to come back. I mean, it's the same freaking story. And in each episode, you know, like, the first one, Le Chiffre, was running this master criminal syndicate. And then there was Quantum, this master criminal syndicate. But no, there's a bigger one, which is Spectre, this massive criminal syndicate. At a certain point, you can't just redo the story and make it bigger and bigger and bigger. I wish they'd go back to what the standard Bond movies were, where they would take Bond, give him a mission, he'd have to go stop somebody, and that would be it. And you'd get the ski chases, and you'd get the car chases, and you'd get the freaky henchmen, and you'd get the Bond girls. But you don't develop the character of Bond because at a certain point, he becomes not Bond or you can't develop him. It's one of the two. So I hope that they rectify some of this because as beautiful of a movie as Spectre is, it is a bit of an empty Bond film. I mean, it still works for fun and I'm still going to give it a Kinda Rocks, but I hope that No Time to Die is better than it.
It Kinda Rocks.
Even though Spectre is not a new release, there are a couple of ones that are available this week, including Skylines, the Raid Collection, and Ultraman Tarot, the complete series. And that's it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about the White Tiger, WandaVision, and Psycho Gorman. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.